Okay, we're gonna get started. So the next section, which I started last time, was about storage management as well as input-output. So we will focus mainly on things that store data. However, a lot of the stuff that I'll cover also applies to input-output, as in screens, keyboards, mice, or networking, printing, etc. But they're kind of a crossover. It's the same thing, but there are some extra issues with storage devices. Storage devices, long-term storage, so today there are two main classes of storage devices: hard disks and solid-state disks, or SSDs. Now, I don't want to predict the future. Is everything going to be SSD? Maybe, maybe not. But more and more, the desktop computing is moving towards SSD. SSD is much more expensive. And while we can probably afford SSDs on laptops and things like that now, it's a lot faster. The problem with SSD comes about in large-scale data farms, where hard drives are the most common form. They have much bigger capacities. They're cheaper. They're easier to swap. You can do. There's a lot better write traffic on hard disks than SSDs. So where there's a lot of database operations, hard drives are preferable. And you can stripe them, RAID them, and do all kinds of fun stuff with them. So I will kind of rudimentary cover SSD, but mostly going to focus on hard drives. Although you can say this is old technology, most of the stuff, similar stuff on SSDs, are taken care of by the hardware. The operating system involvement with SSD is minimal. So when you talk about operating system involvement, the hard drives are a little more involved. So let's look at hard drives first to an extent. We will slowly talk about input-output and then scheduling and things like that. So, or should I do SSDs first? Let's do hard drives because... So my terrible drawing skills, you can visualize what's going on. There are platters, multiple of them, few, that are stacked together in one solid unit, and this thing turns at a very high speed. What is it, 7200 RPM. But so there is a head that is positioned somewhere. So since this is turning, the head will travel along a track. So these are concentric circles. And in the track, there are lots of sectors. That is, each track is divided into sectors. So that's the physical characteristics. And the head can be moved by means of a stepper motor, which can accurately place the head on one of these zillions of tracks. So what we want to take a logical view of this. The logical view of a hard drive So we know we have lots of sectors, n per track. There's the equal number of sectors on every track. So that means the sectors are bigger on the outer edge than on the inner edge, but the capacity of the sector is kept the same, so the outer edge is less dense. That's a problem with circular, but that's how it is. So there's n number of sectors per track. There's a certain number of tracks, m per disk, and so the total disk contains m times n tracks. Now, what about multiple platters? I'm going to ignore it. Let's just say there's only one platter. If there are multiple platters, different brights are arranged in a different way. Now, who takes care of this? What I want as a software person, operating systems designer, I want each block to be a sector, which is how the hard drive is designed anyway. So anything contained in a sector, I term it as a block. And then I kind of visualize that there are blocks on the disk from number 0 to number mn, m times n minus 1, so that is mn blocks, on disk laid out like a sequential array. That's not true. So if I take a block number Q, where is it physically? Oh, you'll have to know which sector, you're going to calculate that. That part is not done by the operating system software. The so-called disk controller maps every sector, track, and all that mess into a block number. And so you send a signal to the disk saying, I want to access block number Q. It will figure out which track it is on and which sector on that track. And then it will automatically move the head to that track. Now, to the track, not to the sector. The sector is going round and round. And then it will kind of figure out when that sector will cross under the head, because it knows about the rotational speed as well as the spatial something of the disk, so that it knows which sector is going where at this point in time. So it waits until that sector comes under the head, and then the head can read or write data from that sector. So that part is done by electronics. We don't need to worry about it. So as far as we are concerned, one disk is a huge number of blocks, each block having a block size, maybe 1K, maybe 4K, depends on the disk. I haven't honed up on the size, but there's a certain number of bytes on that block. Each block is numbered. The disk is read or written by providing an address, which is the block number, and the data that should go on the thing or the data that comes out of the thing. And the unit of read and write is one block. So in a nutshell, this is what happens. So the operating system or whoever needs to put the data to be written in a particular piece of memory, tells the controller the data is at this memory location. It's a fixed sized amount of data because it's equal to the block on disk. And which block number should it go to? How does it tell the controller is something we will look into a little deeper soon. But it tells the controller that. That's the I/O channel. The controller does some magic by which that data gets moved from memory. It's also left back in memory, but it's moved from memory to the correct block on disk. And this will take some time. And the controller has a method of telling the operating system, I'm done. And during this transfer, you shouldn't ask the controller any other thing. It's going to do one by one sequentially. So it'll write the entire memory contents onto the disk. You cannot write a byte or 5 bytes onto the disk. File read-write system calls allow you to write a few bytes, but that's not really true. At the lowest end, you write a block onto the disk. And similarly, read would be exactly the same thing. It'll move the data the opposite direction. It'll read the stuff from the disk and move it to memory. And that's how it works. So how does the communication work? How does it done? How does the device driver work? That's what we are going to look at in a few minutes. And that's the job of the device driver. The SSD, the electronic disks, solid-state disks, are essentially a piece of RAM. So all of its bytes are numbered. And it could have been possible for you to use it as random access memory. But it's not, due to practical reasons, due to standards and things like that. So these RAM addresses are hidden from the rest of the system, and it's not accessible. What is accessible is through the controller. If you look through the controller and you've got these messages to the controller, it looks like the SSD is a hard drive, a mechanical hard drive, even though it's not. So a mechanical hard drive, you talk to it by saying, write this block number, here is the data. That's exactly how you talk to the controller of the SSD. So you say, read from this block number, and the block number will be transformed into a range of addresses instead of being sectors and tracks. And all you say, write to the block number, here is the data, write it. Now, there is a lot more complexity at the hardware level in the RAM, in the SSD, that we OS people don't have to worry about. So a little peek into that, maybe you already know. Okay. SSD writes are slow. Well, it's not as slow as hard drives. It's just slower than reads. SSD read will read the RAM contents and present you the data. It is much, much faster than hard drive because there's no spinning parts, no tracks, heads that are moving and all that stuff. It's just a straight electronic read. SSD write is much slower than that. What it does is it electronically, since it's non-volatile, the data is already burnt in there, in the sense that it is kind of written with some high pulses of electricity which changes the composition of the solid state, something, something, which I don't know. So to write data, you first have to zero out all the data that's on there. So you kind of burn it off by something, I don't know. And then you again burn the data that's to be written in there. So this process of slowly embedding the bits onto the non-volatile flash is a little bit, or quite a bit slower than a read. Not only that, it's kind of destructive. That means you can only do this so many times. After so many times, which is thousands of times, that piece of RAM will be destroyed. So high write traffic on SSDs is highly not advisable, which is why we put SSDs in mainly read-only places, like your computer operating system, all the software, you just write it once, it's there. And there's not much write traffic. However, if you're storing data that is getting updated on SSD, there is something called load leveling that happens. Load leveling is a mystery to me, but what is done first, we separate out the logical block number from the physical block number. That means that there are blocks 0, 1, 2, 3. We say 0 is both logical 0 and physical 0. So this is the same as logical and physical. Now, let's say we've written up to number 3. Then if you try to write block 2, block 1, let's say, you try to write block 1, it will not write block 1. It just wants to not write to already written blocks as much as possible. It will write to block 4. And it will change the logical address 1 to point to... No, it will still say logical address 1, but it will point to 4. So next time you read 1, you'll be reading from physical 4. And again you write 1, this block will move to someplace else. So as you write, you're writing to newer and newer places on the disk. If you've written all of the disks, then it'll refold back to basically not write to the same spot often. And the more free space you have, the better the leveling algorithms work. So the leveling algorithms is kind of interesting. I don't know exactly what algorithms they're using. It's proprietary and built into the SSD chip. So we don't see it. But there is such a thing about messing with the logical block numbers and physical block numbers and remapping them so that the write traffic gets scattered all over instead of that same hotspot where a highly written to block would be constantly written to and then it'll get destroyed. So we spread the destruction around. And that's how all SSDs work. And probably that's how the USB flash drives work. But they probably have a little dumber leveling algorithm. I'm not sure what's in it. Yeah?
Let's say the limit of that physical block was 9. You know, when you got to that point, where would, if you wanted to write somewhere else, where would it go since it's out of room?
If it's out of room, then it'll go back to the one that, and it'll override that. So now, if you're just writing one, the same block over and over again, it's moving around, it's actually reusing itself too, but the amount of writes per block is much lower. It's just spreading the load around. So you need some free blocks. If you have only the nothing free, then it will have to do in-place updates. Yeah?
So this is to stop the step where you have to erase what you already have,
or you just want an empty one? Even the next empty one may have been written to, so you would erase that. You don't know what's in it. So you would erase that. But this erase traffic you want to minimize on a per block basis. So you erase this. Again, if you want to write this, you erase that. So you move things around. So I'm not trying to gain speed. I'm trying not to wear down a particular block, because it only can be erased so many times in its lifetime. Okay? Which is another reason, really, high-volume databases don't care for SSDs. The write traffic is kind of slow. You've got to do load leveling, and it wears out sooner. But things may change down the road. Okay, I don't want to write down everything. I'm kind of oversimplifying. Complex controllers have more things. Think of each controller, which is controlling a disk, a SSD, or a keyboard, or network, etc., has two registers on it. And these registers are on the electronic circuit board that contains the controller. Okay? However, these registers are memory mapped. There are two kinds of I/O operations, I/O channels and memory mapped. I/O channels, I believe, are essentially gone. All controllers are memory mapped. So we'll talk about memory mapping. That is, the MMU kind of makes believe that this register is actually located at a RAM address. So the register is actually in the controller, but through some MMU magic, this also appears as a memory location in RAM. So which means that if you read memory address X, you're reading the register. If you're writing to that memory address, you're updating the register. And these registers contain certain values which are two-way values. One, it could be values that the operating system needs to read to gain information about what's going on, or it could be values that the operating system writes to tell something to the controller. Okay, that's a little nebulous. Can we get the facts? So let's look at the status register. It's probably overkill that I put idle and busy. They're complements of each other. Idle or busy or both would be little bits in the status register that is modified by the controller. You don't touch it. You just check it to see if the device is idle or busy. So you can read the status register. If the idle bit is 1, that means the device is available and the busy should be 0. But there is a bit called the go bit, which the controller does not touch. The controller reads. The operating system sets the go bit to 1, and then the controller notices that and starts doing some work. So we'll talk about what does setting the go bit to 1 do to the controller. And there'll be another set of such bits. One of the bits is the interrupt bit. The interrupt bit tells the controller to send interrupts to the CPU or do not send interrupts to the CPU. It's interrupt enable or interrupt disable at the controller level. And with these bits, the OS can sense what's going on, get information about the device, as well as tell the device to do certain things. So there has to be a read-write bit also. Okay, so to demystify this, this is the sequence of steps that has to be done by the software to write a block to disk. First, SR is the status register. The OS needs to know the memory address of the status register. So that's how it checks for the bits or writes bits to it. So it checks to see if the idle bit is set. If the idle bit is set, then it's great, we can do it. If the idle bit is not set, you have to wait. How do we wait? That we're not going to talk about yet. So maybe it's a busy loop, which is a bad idea, but you could put a busy loop in there. While not idle, do nothing. So then it becomes idle. And then you put the block number in the status register, which is this number B. You put those bits in the status register so that the controller is informed which block am I going to do something to. You set the read-write to write. Read is 0, write is 1. Read-write bit is set to write. Still, the controller is not doing anything. You're setting various bits in its registers. and you put the address of the memory location where the data is located in the data register, so put X in the data register. And the controller will jump to action moment you set the go bit to 1. When you set the go bit to 1, the controller will instruct the head to move to the correct position, wait until the sector comes around, transfer the data directly from memory to that sector. This is called DMA, you may have heard of it, direct memory access. The CPU doesn't do it, the device controller can suck data out of memory without the CPU moving anything from memory and put it directly onto the disk. And when, so the OS can wait for it to be done or go away, it doesn't matter. When it's done, it's going to set the done flag to be true. And that's how it's written. Same thing for read, you just put the R bit on and the destination address in the data register. But this is a far cry from the world of files. We're not used to playing with this stuff. So in the middle, between your program that is reading files, writing files, or reading, writing from network adapters, there is a file system, which is a topic to be covered later. That's a huge lot of data structures which figures out how the block numbers are organized. Then there is the device driver, which does this. And then there is a bunch of scheduling algorithms which takes care of all these waits and wait for done, wait for idle, all that stuff. So this is the lowest end of the operating system. Even lower than this is how do we calculate block numbers into sector numbers or into RAM addresses for SSD. How do we actually do that? We don't need to know. That's the electronics part. Okay, any questions? I'm looking at it from the OS point of view, not the circuit designer point of view. This explained how polled I/O is done, which is as follows. Remember, who is doing these operations of read, write? It's being done by processes. No, it's being done by device drivers. No, it's being done by operating systems. Roll back. The operating system doesn't do anything. You call the operating system and it runs under the context of a process. And it does all this code. There is no dedicated thread in the operating system doing stuff. So it doesn't do read and write. It does read and write when a user process asks the operating system via a system call to do the read or write. So a process one may want to do a read, and a process two may want to do a read on two different disk blocks at the same time, because it's a multi-core system, or because it's concurrent processes. We've been through that. So now both will come and wait for idle. And when the idle turns to idle, they'll both go through. That's not okay. So you need a critical section around this wait for idle, so that only one of them goes through. And why is it not idle? Because the third process is actually using it. Okay? So it might not be idle because somebody is using the disk. Two other processes come and wait for idle. Because of critical sections, one should be able to go through. Then whoever goes through sets up all the bits and waits for done. But while it sets up the bits and does all this, the other processes should not be touching the disk. Now, if this wait for idle is a busy loop, so in polled I/O, these waits are busy loops. So think of the scheduler, what's it doing. It goes to P1. P1 is busy looping. The scheduler thinks P1 is executing, although it's doing nothing. So it'll take up the whole time quanta. It may preempt it and go to P2. P2 will busy loop, take the whole time quanta. You're just wasting time here. Because this wait is really execution as far as the scheduler is concerned. So somehow you've got to retrofit these weights into being blocks and semaphores and critical sections and various things so that it does not busy wait. So we'll have to look at that. And you have to do this one by one. But this is the code that will be in one place, the wait for busy, dump it out, and then wait for done will be in one location in a device driver that multiple processes should be able to access. And that's why that location is called a device driver. You do not read device driver. Okay. This is how the chain of command goes. An application programmer writes printf, or some high-level language routine saying write to this file. That printf call actually calls a printf routine in the user library, or whatever language you're using. The language has a library. And you're printing a line of text or a little number or whatever, and it's converting that and putting it in memory. It's not writing out. When you have written enough material to fill up a block, this guy, the library, keeps track of the stuff you're writing and issues a command to the operating system saying, I've got a bunch of stuff, you need to write it out to file. The operating system does some buffering. The library doesn't know how big your file blocks, the disk blocks are. The OS knows. The OS collects data that is being written into disk block-sized chunks in its buffer space. When it has one or more buffers filled up for that process, it's going to issue a call to the file system saying, here is a block of the file. The file name is blah, 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 and this block is positioned so many blocks away from the beginning of the file. The file system goes, okay, let me figure this out. The file system is actually doesn't exist because there's no names and the file things, all that stuff on disk. The disk only contains blocks in a sequential fashion. So if the file system does this magic of converting where you're doing the printf into a block number. And it takes the material, puts it in some memory location, which is reserved for talking to the device driver, and issues a call to a device driver for the disk, saying, write block, this block number, location of the data. This is what I wrote on the previous page. Then it'll check for idle, busy loop. Then it will start up the operation by talking to the controller through the go bit and the status register and the data register. Then the controller will do the stuff, inform back using the done bit, and then the device driver will return control to here. And this is all going on while the scheduler is clicking away. So yeah, it's messy, but it all fits into place. And if you're using polled I/O, there's a whole bunch of busy looping there which wastes time. Interrupt-driven I/O, on the other hand, is a method by which the device driver and the, you have this disk controller occasionally doing stuff. Whenever it's given something to do, it does it, it sets the done bit on, and in addition to setting the done bit on, it generates an interrupt to the CPU. That's all it does. So it's a simple extension of the device driver. It's exactly the same as polled I/O, except there is a second channel of communication. Please send an interrupt when you are done. And you set that by setting the interrupt bit on, and that's all it does. Now the OS designer has to build a device driver which handles interrupts as well as handles requests from the operating system. So it's written in two pieces. It's really bad terminology here. Sometimes it's called upper half and lower half. I don't know which one's the upper half, which one's the lower half. Sometimes it's called the user half and the interrupt half. The user half is not used by the user, it is used by the operating system. This is where the operating system's call to the device driver of write a block or read a block comes in. So that's the user half. It's on behalf of the user. The user process will enter the user half and execute there. The interrupt half is where the interrupt handler is. Every time there's an interrupt from the disk, this code will be run. And now it's our job to figure out how to do interrupt-driven I/O. No waiting, no busy waiting, and do it in a concurrent environment using processes that the operating system is throwing at you. So let me write the device driver like this. Every time the operating system, a user thread comes into the operating system, goes through the file system, comes to this device driver which says, write me a block from this data address. It first wants a critical section. One by one we will do this. It takes a hold of a critical section. That means most of the time you may not get the critical section because there's some I/O going on. If you don't get the critical section, the semaphore will block you. When you get blocked, you're not running, so there's no busy waiting here. You use the semaphore implementation that blocks. Okay, so if you can get past the P disks, so whenever you're waiting, so you're on a semaphore queue. If you get past the P operation, then you're allowed to use the disk. You're the only person who's gotten past the P operation. You're allowed to use the disk, so you move the block number into the status register of the controller, address into the data register. You set the go bit, which sets the controller into action, and you wait for it, your operation to get done. So you do a P on the done semaphore. So you get put on another queue. And the done semaphore is initialized to zero. So you'll get put on another queue, and you have locked the critical section and gone to sleep inside the critical section, which is fine in this case because you're going to wake up soon. And the other folks who are trying to write to this disk or read from this disk is not allowed to use this disk. It's a physical device, one by one only. Okay? If somehow you wake up from the done, you open the critical section, the next one comes in. And you're done when there is an interrupt. When there's an interrupt, there must be an operation already in motion. That must have been done by somebody inside the mutex, and that somebody must be on the p-done semaphore. So all I need to do is a V on the done semaphore. It'll wake up the correct process, who will open up the critical section, letting the next one in. So semaphores are there all the way down to the device driver. And that semaphore implementation has to be in the kernel. The device driver has to hook up to the kernel semaphore implementation, which hooks up to the kernel scheduler, which makes this interrupt-driven I.O. possible. So we were not wasting our time when we talked about semaphores and concurrency. Now it fits in right into the guts of the operating system. Do you see how this works? So that's an oversimplified version of what a device driver looks like. Now the question is, way back when we started talking about multi-tasking operating system, we said there is CPU bursts and I.O. bursts. Where is the I.O. burst here? And then we said, oh wait, the CPU bursts are done through the quantums in the round robin ready queue. And they finish and they go into the I.O. queues. And then they come back and then they go back into the ready queue. The ready queue is in the scheduler. Where is the I.O. queue? Do you see any queues around here? How are processes that are trying to use a disk? The disk is slow, it's a one by one, and every process will get a time to do its I.O. That stuff is managed right here. Where? I don't know if you can see this, but you should visualize it. A process that's running goes through all this stuff and suddenly hits the p-disk mutex and goes to and becomes blocked. That's when it's that semaphore is taking it out of the ready queue, putting it into a private semaphore queue. That semaphore queue is the I.O. queue. This process is going to stay there until the device is available. When the device becomes available, the process's I.O. burst starts. It does some work in that I.O. burst, and it goes to sleep. Again, because it's not doing CPU work. It goes to sleep till the end of the I.O. burst, signaled by the interrupt, and when it wakes up, its I.O. burst is done. It goes back to the CPU state, and it goes back to executing because it's back in the scheduling queue. And when it does a V on the disk thing, the next fella's I.O. wait part is done, and it goes into the I.O. burst. So what I'm trying to say is that if I go back and look at those old Gantt charts that we used to do, we have process P1, and let's say we have process P2, and P1 see, I didn't want to do this back when we were doing chapter 2 or chapter 3 or whatever it was. But we did Gantt chart saying P1 executes on the CPU, then it executes a 1 second I.O. burst. P2 also has a 1 second I.O. burst, but it has to wait for P1 to get done, then it has a 1 second I.O. burst. So it takes much longer. Right? How is this working? P1 did a P-mutex, P-disk mutex, and there was nobody there. So it immediately got through and started its I.O. burst. The I.O. burst is the time for the disk to move and do things. And so it did, while it was doing it, it was waiting on the done semaphore. And then it got a V operation from the interrupt handler, which freed up and put it back in the ready queue, so its I.O. burst got over here. P2, on the other hand, couldn't get hold of the P-mutex, so it went to sleep on the mutex semaphore. So it did an I.O. wait, waiting for P1's I.O. to get done. When P1's I.O. got done, the P2 did a P-done, which means it's waiting for its I.O. to get done. So this part is the I.O. burst for P2. And P2 had to wait till it got the interrupt saying, you're done. Then P2 goes back into the scheduling queue. So you've kind of come full circle. This chart was there in the Gantt chart. It was mysterious. Now I'm solving the mystery, saying it's all done through semaphores. And different kinds of weights are built in because there are the semaphore queues which serve as the I.O. queues. So we never call them semaphore queues, but all I.O. queues are semaphore queues. That's how processes wait. And the ready queue is where it gets scheduled. And the device driver gets involved in the input-output scheduling. Okay, any questions? And that's what the skeletal device driver for for this device is to. Now you can translate this to a device driver for networks, a device driver for keyboards. Again, processors are supposed to read one character at a time as you're typing. Every time you type a character, it generates an interrupt, and the reading process does a P-done on the keyboard wait queue, and that's how things get done. I'll take questions. Yeah, that's the program, the previous slide. This is the timing diagram. I'm trying to relate it back to the Gantt charts that we did at the beginning of the class, where we didn't put in semaphores or how it's waiting. We just said CPU bursts, I.O. bursts. The CPU bursts are intermixed with various processors' CPU. The I.O. has to be mixed with various processors' I.O. If you have a 1 second I.O. burst, it means you won't be over in 1 second. You've got to wait for your previous one's 1 seconds to be over, and then you start yours, then you get over. And that's all due to the semaphores in the device driver.
P1, are you saying P-done is the whole I.O. burst?
P-done is the wait, start of the wait for the I.O. burst. And this is V-done, sorry. V-done followed by V-mutex takes no time. So V-done followed by V-mutex. But essentially, P-done is zero. P-done makes you go to sleep. V-done wakes you up. V-done is done, being done by the interrupt handler. And that is your IO burst. You're sleeping because your IO is being placed out on this physical device called the disk. And is the disk ready? Is somebody else using the disk? That is being checked by P-mutex. So until you've got past P-mutex and somebody else does the V, you're in the wait queue. And the total wait IO time is your wait time plus your burst time. Let's say P1, P2, P3, all approximately at the same time came to that semaphore called disk mutex because they all want to do IO. Obviously, we understand that they will have to wait for each other. That is one by one. There's only one disk. So which order will it be done by the code that I wrote? This is not a trick question, it's obvious.
First come, first serve,
because P1 will grab the critical section first, P2, P3 will queue up, then you'll get P2, P3. And so this will be okay, so let's talk about first come, first serve. Sounds like a silly question. P1 got there first, it started using the disk. Almost around the same time, P2 came and did a P on that semaphore, it got stuck. P3 came, it got stuck. P1 got done using the disk. Should we pick P2? Well, if the semaphore is first come, first serve, it'll automatically pick P2. Should we do that or should we have some other way? Maybe pick P3. Why am I even going there? Well, because this is FCFS scheduling. Don't we have a stigma against FCFS? But how does it matter in this situation that you're using FCFS? Doesn't seem. With hard drives, it matters. Okay? Because if I choose P1, P2, P3, the disk will service P1, P2, P3 in that order, FCFS. And what exactly might happen if we serve FCFS? So let's now go in to look at the mechanism again of the disk. what I mean by this diagram is that P1 is going to read or write a block that is on an inner track. P2 is destination block on the disk is on an outer track. So this is the spindle. The disk is a cross section. It's a platter going this way. So the head will come up to here and here. This is the playground for the head. So P1 reads an inner track, P2 reads an outer track, and P3 reads an inner track. Now does it make a difference? That when I'm done with P1, who should I do next? P3, it seems like. Why? Closer. How does closer help? Yeah.
You physically
move the head less. Now, if this was RAM, it doesn't make any difference. Random access, equal access time all over memory. Whether you, if you read some memory location here and some memory location there, is the same thing as closer, far, further, doesn't matter. Here we are talking about actual physical gadget moving. Acceleration, velocity, movement time, all that. And closer is better. Now, will this happen? It could have been P1, P2, P3. If it was P1, P2, P3, then you do it that way. But if P2 is rather far and P3 is closer, then let's not do FCFS. So the head movement matters. And FCFS is a toss-up. Sometimes it'll do the correct thing, sometimes it'll do the bad thing. It's not the right way to do scheduling if you're attempting to minimize head movement. So there's two kinds of time involved in reading disks. One is the head movement time. How long are you taking for your arm to move from head position this on this track to position on that track? This is quantifiable. It's so many tracks away. It's always, if you're going to read on track 100 and then track 1000, you're going to move 900 tracks over. And you can calculate the delay, or you can at least say closer is better. There is another one which is much, much harder, which we will not look at. Some people claim they do can do that. Is while you're moving to this track, the thing is also spinning. So when you get to your destination, how long would you have to wait for the platter to come to the right position? Maybe you're better off moving to a little further track and the platter is positioned so that it comes immediately rather than you move to the closer track and the rotational delay messes you up. So this is extremely dynamic. The latency of the disk platter spinning has to be, it's fast, And your head movement and these two added up, can you optimize that? Let's not go there. I can't even imagine how to optimize latency and head movement to get to the quickest track based on two one static and one dynamic thing. Okay? So most OSs do the disk head scheduling, not the latency optimization. That's like serious business. So disk head scheduling is you want to reduce the amount of time you spent in seeking. This is called so seek optimization or latency optimization. We're not going to talk about latency optimization. Yes, right? When does this class end? I mean, now? Okay. So we'll cover several optimization techniques. First come, first serve, we already said was bad. There's something strange about SSTF also. And then we'll move on to file systems.